The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
You see that you did a tenure at General Mills. It would be a dereliction of journalistic duty if I didn't ask you what your favorite breakfast cereal is since you worked at General Mills. What would that be?
Well, I was brand manager of Wheaties and brand manager at Cheerios as well. So, you know, I have to say Wheaties is my favorite cereal that I never eat.
And is this because you're not a cold cereal eater anymore?
No, I still eat cereal, but I think, you know, the interesting thing about Wheaties was it really was the cereal that people would buy but never would eat. You know, we'd put Jordan on the box, or we did a promotion with Clyde Drexler, and funny story about that, but we'd put that in, you know, that'd be in the northwest part of the country, and it'd be promotional, and people would buy the box. And we used to have this we used to be able, from diary panel, we used to be able to track what people ate, so we'd get our sales, and we know what we sold through in, you know, in any given city, and then we'd be able to compare that to how much, you know, had actually been eaten. And you know, sort of, Wheaties always had the lowest, rate of consumption to sales.
They're collector's items, aren't they, some of those?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. A lot of them are. And so, you know, we had all sorts of great stars on the front of the box, and people would buy those really just for collector's items.
And does Wheaties still do that, the athletes?
They still do. And I was, you know, we had... It was really an interesting brand. It's still a brand that's sort of, you know, I don't know. I shouldn't answer for today. This was, you know, it's going on a little over 20 years ago when I was running that brand. But, you know, it was interesting. It was a time when, you know, we didn't really pay the athletes a lot to be on the box. I mean, it was part of their childhood, you know, seeing their heroes, and they would still remember that. And, you know, I had one superstar, you know, his agent was asking for tons of money, and I just said, well, we don't do that, and got word through the NBA back to the player that his agent was being difficult, and I get this voicemail from him that says, you know, I'll be on the box for free. And, you know, and it just sort of brought joy, right? You know, this is in the early 90s, and, you know, sports contracts were going crazy at the time, and endorsements, and all of that, and yet here was this one brand that, you know, kids, you know, or, you know, athletes sat as little boys and girls and ate and saw their heroes on it, and when they became the star, they still carried that sentiment with them, and still felt to be an honor to be on it on the box, and so we enjoyed that and used that in quite a bit.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a more selective honor than being on the cover of Sports Illustrated, because you only did how many athletes a year?
You know, we did, we started getting, it would appear to people that we would only do one or two, but what happened as sports really started regionalizing, you know, really kind of in the 70s and the 80s, and so we adopted a strategy where we would do an athlete in the Northwest, but that box would only go to the Northwest, so it might be Clyde Drexler in the Northwest, or, you know, it might have been Ewing in New York or whatever, and so
yes.
we would limit the exposure, even though we might use, you know, somewhere, you know, 5 to 10 different athletes in a market area. They would only see, you know, Jordan was our primary sort of athlete on the box day in and day out, and then we would do a special edition of something, you know, of someone, you know, in their region that was local, and, you know, sports is really localized. We, you know, the day, you know, day and age of Babe Ruth, you know, have come and gone, right? Where there was a national hero that everybody.
Sure. Well, Michael Jordan was a national cereal box, right?
Yeah, he was, and we used him that way. And occasionally, you'd get an Olympian, you know, that you would use. You know, you get that sort of one national hero, and it's sort of a bright light for a short period of time. You'd see that come about. Do that, so we did that, but we did that kind of stuff. So it was still sort of a selective view or a selective impression, but yet you would, you know, we'd be able to sort of really tailor it to different geographies.
Tell me about your tenure at General Mills. I mean, obviously you've told me a little bit, Was that straight out of college that you ended up there, or had you cut your teeth somewhere else, then got hired on as a brand manager? And what was your time like there? What were maybe some of the highlights or some of the major lessons you learned?
So I came to General Mills right out of Carleton. They decided, just happened to be the year I was graduating, they decided that they would put non-MBAs into the marketing area, which was something new for them at the time. They typically hire a class of 40, at that time, somewhere between 40 and 50 sort of MBAs, and they decided that they'd hire a few less MBAs and hire some undergrads. And, you know, I think sort of they obviously paid us a little bit less. So I got hired into that program. It was great. I got put into this division that the whole division was falling apart. And it was an acquisition the company had made. For me, the best part was, when you have chaos, amongst chaos is nothing but opportunity for somebody who's new. And because everyone's trying their best to make things work, so good ideas will rise to the top. And so that was my first experience there. 9 months after I got there, General Mills decided to do a reduction in force, in particular the marketing area. And so of the 15 people they hired, 13 people got let go. And I fortunately was one of two that got to stay on, and actually ended up being promoted as sort of a full MBA sort of employee at that point. And so that was a... It was an interesting day. I was expecting to pack my boxes and go home. instead, they said, no, we're actually going to keep you. So that, was not what I expected. I think when you think about sort of days in your career where, you remember for a long time, that was definitely one of them. I went from there, from that division, I worked in new product development for a bit. And one of the things I realized after all that happened is, they just let go, basically 80% or 90% of the people they hired that didn't have MBAs. I may have made it through that, but I better go get my MBA. And I looked around at the schools that Mills recruited from, and it was the top MBA schools in the country. And so I looked at Chicago, and they offered their full-time program. Had classes in Hyde Park, but they also offered classes at their downtown campus on Saturdays and evenings. So I looked at the flight schedule and I said, I can take a couple classes a semester and fly, I'll just fly down Saturday morning and I'll go to class all day and fly home and I'll work at General Mills during the week. And I was a young guy, probably 22 or 3 at the time, and had lots of time on my hands. And so I did that for the first half of my MBA. And so why did I go to Chicago? Well, I went there because reputationally it was a very strong school. It was part of the schools that Mills recruited from, and it also offered this opportunity for me to really continue to learn. I was learning a ton at General Mills in marketing, and I figured Chicago had a great finance background, and I would combine those two things sort of as a foundational component for general management long term.
So let's talk about recovery engineering. You played a role there in developing and branding, and then eventually selling the Pure water filtration system. Is that synonymous with Purelator? Was that the same?
No, Purelator was a different.
That's something different. Okay, but then totally that system that you had got sold to P&G for 100% premium over market value, which is pretty amazing. Tell me a little bit about that experience and what you did there at Recovery Engineering.
I might tie a little of General Mills into it as well. Let me leave you with one. I'll wander a little bit, I'll get right to topic. You tell me if it's worth it or not. But one of the things that you asked a little bit about Carleton. At Carleton, I was a history major, so I wrote a ton. And when I went to the University of Chicago, it was great because I would get drafted. I was amongst these people who much stronger quantitative skills than I had, but they always need someone to translate it and write it up. That was my history background came into the great thing about history is you have to synthesize a bunch of data and turn it into something coherent. And I got that same challenge at Chicago and loved it, and sort of got drafted by people to write up projects that were much smarter than I ever would be. and you know, you learn as much from the people you're with as you do from the professors. But when I was at, to your question of recovery engineering, I'll start a little bit with General Mills. One of the things, I have always been quantitatively sort of, you know, more of a quant person, and when I was at General Mills, one of the things when you're in consumer marketing or packaged goods marketing is there's always this trial and repeat concept, meaning, you know, when you go to the store, you might have, you know, a sampler at the end of an aisle, and they spend a lot of money to give you samples, and the whole question is, what's your repeat characteristics? Yeah, you sort of have these gold standards cereals at the time, and you know, things, consumer tastes and preferences have changed since then. But at the time, Honey Nut Cheerios was considered to be sort of one of the gold standards in the industry in terms of meeting consumer needs. And so when you have something like that, you do a tremendous amount of trial, and your return is great because your repeat essentially is what pays for that sort of burst of promotional activity or essentially client acquisition or customer acquisition, and eventually leads to profit. And so I did a lot of analytics when I was there around, you know, how do you really measure these things, and are they truly, you know, are they truly getting the return you expect, and is the lifetime value of that make sense? And when I went to recovery engineering, they were basically in the camping business, and they also did desalinators for the military, but they were entering in with what I call more mainstream consumer products, both a pitcher filter and a faucet filter. And most of the people in that industry, not all, but most, looked at it as a durable product, meaning they're selling a durable, like you're selling an iron, you have to make money with that sale, and you know, right off the bat. And my perspective was different, which was, well, more of a razor and blade business or a lifetime value business, which meant really what you have to think about is how can I create a situation where the client, you know, loves the product, values the product, and ultimately the client or consumer is more valuable to us than our competitor on a lifetime value basis, which means that we can flat out just spend more money to attract them. And it gets back to that same concept of the sampler at the end of a cereal aisle. And so, you know, we created a lot of lifetime value models. We entered the business in 94, fairly, you know, a lot of competitors in the space, one of which was Brita, which was owned by Clorox at the time. And by the time we got to 99, beginning of 99, which was the year we ended up selling in, we were the market share leader. And we were the market share leader because, you know, it's fairly straightforward. We just simply thought about how aggressive we could be. We took that and translated that down into decision criteria that we could push all the way out to our sales group. They could all thought out decisions, and it was really all about what's the lifetime value of that consumer, and in such a way that they're more valuable to us, we could be more aggressive about getting them to try our product. And so that it matters. I mean, essentially how we developed, we had tremendous modeling from how we got there, and when we went to market, we were much more attractive to packaged goods companies than we were to the classic durables. Packaged goods just had a higher, you know, there's more premium value than, you know, manufacturers of durable or hard goods like that. And so they thought about it from that perspective. Our modeling fit. It fit into a consumable. At the time, P&G really didn't have, they didn't really work in that space. It worked more in consumables. But they saw this as a consumable, even though it had that component of durable to it. And so we just had a whole different type of auction process. Goldman Sachs led our process, and it was just a completely different set of people than you would have normally expected, or who would have been thinking about that business 5 years earlier.
The pure water filtration system, is it one of the pitchers that you pour water into and it filters it? Or is this a different type of system that goes under the sink and takes water out through a separate, like, through the sink?
So we,
through the plumbing?
Yeah, we ended up having basically three different formats. so one was a pitcher, one was a faucet, and one was essentially an under sink type approach. The more hardware-ish you got, the smaller your universe was. So pitcher was universally interesting to the population and ultimately would be sort of the leading selling item. the faucet and the undersink, they just get, it gets progressively more toolish or hardware-ish, and you lower your, you sort of shrink your base of people who would be interested. So we approached it in terms of offering in all three places, and we had a very aggressive distribution strategy. And that, because we had those different products, it allowed us to have a very aggressive distribution strategy. You would find our pitchers at a place like Bed Bath & Beyond, and you'd find our undersink stuff at a place like Home Depot.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It allowed us to be broadly distributed into those areas, and we also had a strategy of a good, better, best approach around efficacy as well. And again, it was just, you know, when you think about, I mean, it's a mass consumer product. You have to think about, okay, well, how can I create a, you know, as big a net as possible that legitimately meets consumer needs within this, and then tie it into a distribution strategy that you can, you know, be present at the point of purchase.
So Procter & Gamble comes along and in essence says, you're market leader, we'd like to buy your product. It was a big score, 100% premium again, over market value. So once that took place, that sale happened, how long were you with Recovery Engineering, or did you leave after that?
No, I stayed for about another 6 months after that, and helped with the transition, and it was, you know, they had offered me a couple different opportunities, you know, one of which was they wanted to bring the brand global, and I would have had a role to lead the brand, or, you know, sort of roll the brand out to their country managers and things like that. At the time, I had a one-year-old and another one on the way, and the thought of traveling internationally for weeks at a time, it was not appealing. Had it been 4 years earlier, I would have jumped at it. But I really was at a place where I had been traveling quite a bit, and I just wasn't ready to hit the road quite like that with two new kids. And so did a couple things. One is when we were a very marketing driven company, and I remember when I told my staff, I had 26 people who worked for me. I told my staff that being purchased by Procter & Gamble, they all immediately looked at me and said, we're not going to have jobs. You know, they're a great marketing organization, and you know, why would they keep us? And I looked at all of them, and I said, well, I think that's the wrong way to think about it. In fact, they are really interested in our firm because of the way we've marketed. And so our job is to continue to demonstrate all the things we've done until the purchase occurs. And in that process, I actually, 25 of the 26 people got offers to stay with P&G. And most everyone took them and continued in, you know, fairly lengthy careers with P&G. So, you know, that's one of those things where it was, people would say, oh, isn't it great, you led this company. I was pretty young at the time and publicly traded, and probably shouldn't have been publicly traded. We're probably too small to have been publicly traded, but publicly traded and went through this great sale. You know, we grew it, you know, $14 million when I got there, was $105 million in revenue and quite profitable when we sold it, in basically a 4.5-year stint. And, you know, I said, well, that's nice, but that isn't really what motivates me to run to work every day. You know, I'm motivated. One of the things, I wanted to build a brand that people valued. And, you know, I said it was great that P&G, one of the great brand companies of the world, valued the brand and bought the firm. I said the other thing is I really worked with a great group of people and created the opportunity for them to continue. They were all relatively young in their careers, and, you know, really created a springboard for them with a fabulous marketing company. And that was great. For me, I had left General Mills very thoughtfully. I had... about a year before I took the job with Pure, I had spent some time with an industrial psychologist and realized that I just had an entrepreneurial need. I loved General Mills. I loved the people I work with. But for me, I needed a more entrepreneurial setting in terms of where I needed to be. And so I'd left General Mills deliberately. The thought of going back to P&G, which essentially is a similar form of General Mills, in traveling around the world, you know, it just didn't add up for me. And so I left Mills. Some people had been invested in recovery engineering called me up and said, we've invested in this technology company, and we really don't know what it is. And it helped. And so, you know, this is 99. I mean, you know, anyone could raise money in a technology company at that point. So I helped them position themselves.
Well, what company was it?
It was a company called, well, at the time it was called E-Systems, which doesn't tell you a whole lot. Eventually, it so we had investors. We came up with an outlandish name, like many companies did. It was called Wizmo, and essentially it was an application service provider, hosting applications centrally for people and really taking, you know, reducing IT costs. And it was a crazy time. And we raised capital in the company. I was there for about 18 months. My father developed cancer, and I continued on with the company, but asked to take a leave. Shortly after he passed away, Recovery Engineering, a friend of mine called me up about Wealth Enhancement Group and said they have this great consumer marketing bent to them. They don't really know how to do it perfectly. He said, you should do this. So I think he asked me about how did I get in financial services or what attracted me to it. It was really more about the business model that the firm had, which is financial services is such a business of, it's such a sales-driven business, so much in terms of sales, you know, relationship sales, networking, those types of things, all of which are very valuable. What attracted me here was the firm did it completely different, and the model was unique in that it had a marketing organization based on really more of an educational approach, and clients would call here. And it's really what I would call a true marketing-driven firm. There's marketing, right, that makes brochureware and things like that. I mean, every company has that. But this firm had a true marketing-driven organization in which it would create events and done a radio show for a long time, which is formatted around a subject and sort of educational in terms of how it talks about it. And lo and behold, people call us. And we then fit them into the right place. And they call us. It's always important, you know, from a marketing perspective, we present, here's what we do. And that allows people, you know, people who call us usually are looking for what we do. You know, so many times if you do networking, you know, you find one client or another client, they may have completely different needs. In our situation, we look, most of our clientele look relatively similar in terms of their mindset and who they are and what they value and what they're looking for. And so it creates a very, you know, that's basically what marketing is. Marketing, you make a consumer promise, consumer responds, and then you have to deliver on it.
Well, let's back up a minute, because you were with a couple consulting firms, right? And one of which you worked with, Wealth Enhancement Group, before you came over to be the chief executive there.
I did do a little work with a group called the Platinum Group, local firm, primarily focused in on small to mid-sized companies and transitions. And I did that when I took a leave from Wizmo. We were looking at buying a company together, and I did some work with them for a period of time, but nothing extensive.
So was it?
I'm not a tremendous consultant. I'm an operator.
You like to, okay, now, but with MZ, was that the consulting firm that you were working with, Wealth Enhancement Group, or was it through Platinum?
When I came to work with these guys, what happened is it was about a week after my dad passed away, a friend of mine called me, and he said, they figured out the marketing thing, but they really need help in rationalizing it. And so so I started working with them, and they were going through a transaction at the time, and they really weren't, they had roughly about $600 million in assets as a firm, and they really weren't prepared to do a transaction. And essentially, they're bringing outside capital because their growth rate was reasonably strong, and they need capital to fund from a working capital perspective. And so I came in, helped them really position themselves through both recovery engineering. I mean, when I was there, we did a secondary, we did a pipe, and then we did an auction process, and then I'd been through the private equity side at Wizmo. And so I'd spent a lot of time, you know, terms of sort of the corporate finance side, which, you know, marketing, ultimately that is a marketing activity in terms of positioning the firm. And so got involved here in their process, helped them just organize it in a better way, helped them position the company in a way that was reflective of who they were, and just be get ready for a transaction. And, you know, in the middle of that process, I was on a plane with the guy that was running the company. We were about 2 weeks. So we had gone past the, we'd gone to a finalist. We were down to final negotiation of the purchase agreement. And about 2 weeks out from the close, the CEO of the company looks over at me and he says, we're on a plane, he says, I don't want to run the company anymore. And I was like, well, that's great timing. And he said, I think you should run it. And I said, well, that's a little awkward and not my decision, but I appreciate the support or confidence. And so he essentially, like so many of these firms, I mean, he was an advisor manager of the firm. And even at $600 million, these guys were functioning more like a business than just a pure small advisor group. And so I knew the two gentlemen that were buying the firm, and had gotten to know them quite well through the process, and I had known one of them from before. And he went to them and suggested this, and so I had lunch with them, and I said, well, I tell you what, I'll run it until you find somebody that can run it. And so, 6 months turned into, you know, going on now, we're on 15 years. And
2003, you took over as CEO, and now are you still the CEO because you really liked what you were doing, or was it just inertia? I mean, there's some centrifugal force.
A couple of things. I mean, I love. I'm a marketing guy by background, and I'm a marketing guy. You know, not. I believe in, you know, Mills fundamentally teaches you, you know, what I call solid foundational marketing, meaning, you know, you can get people to buy things, but it's really not about getting people to buy things. It's to get people. It's really to understand at a fundamental level what are consumer requirements and what do you need to do to deliver on them and how do you communicate it to them. I mean, that's foundational marketing, and I love that. And so my whole family we're all sort of out of that ilk, and so. You know, what I loved about this company, I loved about the challenge was exactly that. And especially in finance, especially in what I call services, any kind of services business is very difficult to think about. You know, if I'm marketing, you know, a can of Coke, I can tell you sort of what it tastes like and, you know what, we manufacture it and it's going to come out the same way every time and I don't have to worry about any inconsistencies on that promise. Services are, you know, the inventory are people.
Right.
You know, people with brains.
They don't always perform as you instruct them to, or they have good days and bad days, personality conflicts, who knows what.
That's right. That's exactly right. And so I loved that challenge. I mean, when you think about service brands, you know, there's not a tremendous, you know, it's pretty easy to name off strong brands that are related to a consumable or a durable product. It's a little harder to come up with great service brands that are powerful and have been around for a long time. And so I loved that challenge. And, there's a fairly boring book called Management Lessons from the Mayo Clinic. I mean, Mayo Clinic, the brand's been around for a while. It's enjoyed a great reputation for 50 years. And it really, you know, they talk, within this talks about sort of this concept of, you know, there's a presented brand and then there's the service. And how do you finally get there? And it's all about culture. If you don't have a culture, you can't order someone to do something, or you can't order someone to do something in a sustainable way. Instead, it has to be, you know, it has to be a culture that perpetuates that, and it has to be reinforced. So we, you know, one of the big things, you know, in some of the questions, you know, talk about the round table, one of the big fundamental propositions that we make to our clients is that it's a team-based approach. And while they'll have a primary advisor who is from a relationship perspective, that person isn't the only person that's involved in their, you know, their situation and working through it. And in fact, in this business, the complexity of planning is such that you have to really think about how can I manifest expertise around the different areas of a client's life and deliver that in a way that's efficient to that client. And so the concept of the round table is quite simple. It's just an advisor will have a client. They create essentially a case, which is part of the planning process. They come to the round table with that case, and they discuss it. And in that meeting, we'll be sitting, you know, we'll have our estate planning, someone from our estate planning group, someone from our risk management group, someone from our investment area, someone from, fellow advisors that might be there, tax planning, et cetera, and they go through the different issues. And, you know, a good advisor is going to know most of the different areas they need to explore and consider, but you know, there's two purposes, or several purposes of this round table, but essentially it is, you know what, if you bring a couple different minds to a problem and you have people who have specific expertise, you're going to come up with better solutions. That's the first goal. The second goal of it is planning can get sort of esoteric or complicated and can be incredibly, if it's complicated, the client's not going to do anything. And so you can come up with the absolute best solution for a client, but if you don't understand how to communicate it to the client, they're not going to do it, and they shouldn't. So the other part of that process is, okay, how can you take this concept and bring it to the client so that they understand it? And by understanding it, then they will be able to make a decision or an informed decision on whether it's appropriate or not for what they envision their future to be. So, you know, that's the second component. And the third component, one of the things is most all of our advisors here that are in our established geographies are internally developed. And what that roundtable process does is brings this planning, you know, takes planning, which some people sort of do in a black box or sort of just at their computer, and it starts to bring it out, and people participate, and our junior folks participate and they understand, and it's a total learning process for them so that one day they'll be able to contribute back to that as well. And so that's, when we think about it, client-centric around getting multiple people thinking about the problem, manifesting expertise to the client in an efficient way, and developing more talent as we grow.
So what do you mean by internal development? Youngsters that you teach your way rather than bringing in so-called stars?
Yeah, so We do acquisitions, but we primarily use acquisitions as a way to enter a new market. If you look at walk through, you know, Minneapolis St. Paul, I haven't recruited an advisor in Minneapolis St. Paul in it's probably been 10 years. We grow because we a lot of firms grow, as you know, they might have a hiring bonus that they might pay to an advisor to leave, one wirehouse and go to another one, or one place to next. Or they might acquire, they might develop or grow their business through acquiring firms. When I started off here, Minneapolis, St. Paul business, we had a few offices in Minneapolis, St. Paul with $600 million in assets. Today, we're roughly $4.5 billion. The Minneapolis St. Paul area, and that's been entirely organic growth through our marketing activity, developing client interest, which we then, the way our process works, we develop client interest, they call in, we have a new client team that listens to them, finds out what they're looking for, starts to nurture that interest and understand it, and then actually schedules that client when they're ready onto an advisor's calendar. So our advisors are really in a place to serve. They're not out hunting around for new clients, which is fine. It's the way most industry works. But our advisors, you know, we want our advisors to be there to serve clients. And so that's how we've grown it. Now, as we go into a new market area, Chicago is a good example. We bought a firm in Chicago. It was about a $250 million firm. Essentially 2014. Today, that firm's rough, through organic growth, and we did one tactical, Chicago's a big place. We're looking for more advisor talent there in a faster fashion. We did a tactical acquisition great firm in a good geographic spot so that we have, you know, a nice sort of office layout. You know, but that group's grown, you know, roughly fourfold in that period of time. And it really is, you know, it's really in that, and then down there we've developed a fair amount of talent as well and promoted, I think, two or three people to advisors and developed them, and we'll continue to do that. So, you know, when you can develop new clients through a process, you're really in a different place in terms of, because I really think you can teach planning, teach investment management to people. Rainmaking, it's hard to teach. It's not impossible to teach, but it's hard to teach rainmaking to people, and that's really where more of our marketing and activities there really take over for that. And, you know, we can focus more on hiring just really solid talent around doing financial planning and investment advice.
So when you acquire another office, you inculcate those members, these new members, with the roundtable methodology. Is that right? And your other processes.
We do. Although it's I'm always open to learning, and so I spoke last year at a Barron's conference, and I always tell, you know, when people ask me, you know, so many people want to, in the wealth management RA space, there's a lot of acquirers these days, and, you know, when people ask me, well, you know, how does it work? And one thing I always tell people is, well, if you're going to start acquiring business, don't look at it as you're the hammer and they're the nail. Because this, for two reasons. One, this is a service business, and the second reason is there's still a tremendous amount to be learned. And so even when we bought this firm in Chicago, there's a number of things that we liked that they were doing. And we said, great, what we're really good at is creating, institutionalizing that process and creating it into a repeatable process that can be used by others. And so, yeah, a lot of what we do, obviously we're the acquirer, and a lot of what we do goes into what they're doing. But that said, you know, we bought the firm because we really respected who they were and what they were doing, and you know, picked up a couple of things that we've added into what we say across the firm. And, you know, we're still, you know, people look at me and say, oh, you guys are a big firm in the RA space, and I'm like, no, I still feel like a small firm. We might be, but you know, we have big aspirations, and I still think of this as a small business.
So let's talk about the roundtable a little bit, which you just did, but I wanted to just point out that I saw that, you know, you bring together a team of specialists and advisors in six core areas. You were naming some of those up. I immediately thought of the Mayo Clinic method of, and that's actually where it came from then, it sounds like. And did it come to the firm through you, Jeff, or was this a pre-existing condition, so to speak, at the firm, and you took it from there? I might as well carry the medical, theme.
Yeah. Well, it there's sort of two things. They had done it before I got here, and then as 2001 and all the 9/11 and everything that happened with that, they sort of had gotten away from it a little bit. And as I came back in, I asked questions about, well, what are the things that have made this firm great? And I kept hearing about this round table. And at the same time, there was a sort of looking to Mayo, and my wife happens to be a doc, and you know, there's sort of, you know, they have mortality and morbidity clinics, which, you know, basically is review of cases. And it's a discussion. And so it is. It's a little bit of both. I mean, there was history of it being in the company, and it was something that people really valued. They had gotten away from it a little bit, and at the same time, I was thinking about it from exactly the medical side, and really about sort of, you know, how do you really manifest? And in essence, what you're trying to do is you're trying to, you know, manifest expertise. We're in the service business, and specifically planning, and you know, our job is to figure out how can we manifest our best answer for our clients. And in order to do that, we have to have a forum by which we can take sort of bits and pieces, you know, from, you know, our estate planning group. You know, they don't need to be involved in every aspect of a client's life to have a major impact on them, and that's the efficiency that we're able to deliver by using the roundtable approach.
So the roundtable approach, the advisor meets with the round table. The client is not brought into that process. This is so that the advisor can get the expertise, can benefit from the expertise of the of a fuller, you know, a team of experts, and then come up with a more informed plan or strategy for the client. Is that right?
Yeah, that it is. Although the client will be exposed to it. So let's say they'll be exposed. They're going to be exposed in a couple ways. First of all, the advisor is going to tell them about the process. It's important. One of the things that we've done, you've done a lot of, you imagine, consumer marketer, we've done a lot of consumer research over the years, primary research as opposed to secondary research. And, you know, you hear clients talk about they have a guy. I mean, that would be the classic sort of translated into consumer speak. I have my guy. But they, when you dig underneath that a little bit, they're a little bit unsettled by it because they don't know anyone else from the firm. And they wonder, to some extent, does anyone else at that firm know me? And so we saw that as it's a consumer need. At the end of, you know, at the end of the day, one of the things, I mean, obviously our goal is to provide, you know, great financial advice that optimizes the tax and, you know, find, you know, puts them in exactly the right type of portfolio. Absolutely. I mean, those things are somewhat measurable in what we're trying to do. But really what we're trying to do is give people peace of mind. Peace of mind that their financial plan is consistent with their goals and values and what the world may bring to them. We saw that as this doubt about, you know, what happens to me if that guy isn't the guy or who else knows me. So the firm has always been team-driven. And I can talk a little bit about its founding if that's helpful to it. It's always had a strong team concept to it. It was really more a matter of someone like myself thinks about positioning. How do I translate that culture into a way that clients can understand it? One of the things, and back to the Mayo talks a lot about clues, which is when you have a service, it's not tangible. So you have to actually provide clues to the consumer that you're delivering on what the promise is. So our promise would be teamwork. In that process, typically through the planning process, the advisor might listen and talk to the client about what their needs are and determine what's the right planning approach. There's a lot of different ways you can take planning. What's the right planning approach? But as it goes forward, most of the time that client's going to hear from somebody else on a general planning perspective, and they may even hear from somebody else in a specific area. It might be they might have a risk management issue. So we have a very strong, we've always had it around an extremely tight CRM system so that, you know, the client, when someone calls, they know what's going on with that client, and they pick up right where somebody else left off. So the advisor may hand off to the planner to run the planning activity. Advisor will say, you know, Mr. Client, we're going to go through this. We're going to create a case study. We're going to have more people look at this. This planner is actually going to contact you in this process and may bring other people. So it might be a risk management issue. Our risk management group's going to reach out and call them directly and talk to them. And ultimately, Mr. Client, we're going to bring this all back to a coherent plan to you. And so the client's going to feel they're going to feel well taken care of. I mean, they're going to get that those clues of a team of people being involved. It's not just round table. It's going to maybe for places that need deeper amounts of information or whatever it might be. They're going to hear from them and make sure that we get it right.
So did the roundtable concept come from the Mayo Clinic? Because the Mayo Clinic is based in what? Rochester, Minnesota. And you guys are based in the Minneapolis area. You're how far away from the Mayo Clinic? Just, you know, mile wide.
It's about an hour and a half drive.
Okay, an hour and a half drive.
The roundtable came from the founders. And the three founders, an interesting group, you know, that came together. This is in 97. One was a trust, a gentleman from the trust, JD CPA, came from Resource Trust. Strong, very strong planning capabilities. Another one came from the insurance industry and had a gift. So the gentleman came from the trust side. He really had a great gift for process and organization and how can I create a, in essence, he came out of a place, you know, a firm that served 25 million plus and said, you know, we're going to work with clients less than that, and I want to figure out how can I deliver planning to a smaller client and do it efficiently but deliver the benefits to them. So he was very process-driven and thoughtful, and he really was the thought behind the round table is, okay, here's a way that I can bring expertise and essentially bring it to the client and then let those experts go work elsewhere. So it's a strong sense of central support to the advisors. The other gentleman came from the insurance industry. He had a gift to talk and take complicated ideas and make them intriguing to people. So, you know, how do I do a tax-free exchange of real estate? Well, you know, that's not the most interesting subject, but he has a great gift to make it interesting and help people realize that that might be a situation where they need to think about it. And so he was more of the person who'd be out there speaking about the firm. And then the third gentleman, he had a great gift to motivate people and sell. And so the three of them came together and really all brought their own talent. So they had a teaming approach from the very beginning of the firm. And so the round table came from a gentleman named Dave Hess, and he brought that kind of, I really don't know where Dave got it from, but I think as we reinvented it and brought it back, it was really the amount of sort of the culture really yearned for it to come back, and combined with sort of my view of the medical world and Mayo and how it made sense as a way to really talk to clients and understand that this really is a team-based approach.
So is it three founders that you named off? Was it three of them?
Okay, there are three founders.
Are they all with the firm still?
Two of them have retired, and one of those two still does some consulting work with us. He lives in Wisconsin, and he recruits for us or finds potential acquisition targets for us. And he's 75. He just loves the business. Another gentleman's named Bruce Helmer, still with the firm. Still does a lot of speaking on behalf of the today. The other one's a gentleman named Dave Hess, and he's retired and lives in Florida.
So as CEO of the firm, you're not an advisor. You're not, it sounds like what you do is you run it as a chief executive, as an operations guy, and you're not involved in meetings with clients and whatnot. You run it as a business, as an operator. Is that accurate, Jeff?
That is accurate. We have a management team entirely dedicated to running and growing the business. You know, growing and thinking about how can we continue to develop, you know, how can we continue to understand what clients need and develop services for them. You know, so growing it in terms of our ability to serve clients, growing it in terms of our ability to grow geographically and expand the firm itself.
Okay, so I want to go back in time again for just a minute. You went to Carleton College.
All right.
It's ranked among the nation's best colleges, a small private liberal arts college. And you study history. It happens to be in the historic river town of Northfield, Minnesota. So the theme is consistent. So you go to school to study history. Were you planning on being an historian or a college professor who taught history? Or was it just a burning interest of yours so you decided I'm going to delve in?
Well, I was actually an econ major when I started. By the end of my sophomore year, by the end of my sophomore year, I was nearly done with my econ major. I had one class to take. And I looked and I said, you know, when I'm 60 years old, am I going to really care about this stuff? And I had taken a couple history classes, one in particular called Chaucer's England. And just loved it. And, you know, there's different types of historiography in terms of, you know, the approach and the particular approach that Professor used was literary sort of reading of the literature of the time and then interpreting how that literature sort of really commented on history. And Chaucer's England, you know, Canterbury Tales is just a sort of epic, you know, story about the times. And So I was completely, I loved it. It, you know, that was where my love was, and so I said, you know, I'm going to a liberal arts school. I've basically taken a tremendous amount of econ and math, and you know, I'll figure. I knew I was going to go into the business world. And I said, you know, but I don't need to start now. And so I switched my majors. I was a history major. I went to Harvard used to offer, I don't know if they still do, they used to offer a summer session. So one summer I went out there and took some business courses so that I could at least demonstrate my interest in business. And I actually ran a couple small businesses out of my dorm room as well. So I was always business-minded. My family also, we started a business at that time that I was involved with as well. And so I always had a strong business interest in my life. But I said, you know, I'm at a liberal arts college. This is what... You know, this is a place to do this. And so I loaded up in history classes, loved it. I think I had two courses to take, you know, like nine more or something like that in a period of basically a year and a half, and loaded up. I was writing all the time, and my room was stacked with books all over the place. but I loved it. So I sort of immersed myself in something that I was passionate about, So I do it, and had no intention of being a history sort of, you know, going on to becoming a history professor at all. I thought it was the opportunity that was presented to me, and make the best of it.
Okay, interesting. So there's also a three-step process at the firm called Unify. What is a Unify process? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, in essence, the goal of it is, you know, simplify the complexity of financial decisions such that that the client themselves feel comfortable with making the decision. And so, you know, the first thing is, you know, starts with just how do you organize, right? Organize their financial situation. And you know, people will do, you know, to different varying degrees, people will do financial statements, right? You think everyone does a financial statement. But you know, really, you know, create a solid financial statement along with sort of what are the things that are sort of off the balance sheet that are actually pertinent to their financial life, and help them organize it. And you know, then, you know, we don't have this view that says, oh, we're just going to tell you, you know, this is what you should do, Mr. Client or Mrs. Client, because you know, that's a weak relationship. Instead, we really want to have a collaborative relationship, because the truth of the matter is we go through this process, and aside from understanding the financial statement, we also want to understand their values. It's important to understand their values, because it has a great impact on how we might recommend what they do. But at the end of the day, they really have to, you know, they have to help us interpret that as well to get there. And so we want our clients to be collaborative with us. We want them to, it's not that we want them to do our job, but we want them to understand enough such that they're not removed from the decision making. And then it's really, you know, once we get on that path, then it's okay. Let us be your guide as we navigate through a whole range of financial decisions that have to be made, but are consistent with the plan we've laid out. And so, it's ultimately, how do you simplify it? And in doing that, it's based on organization, it's based on discussion, collaboration around. You understand what we're trying to do. You understand your values, and then let us go. Then now work the deep of that. You know, one of the things I remember when we went to this, this concept of values as a way to understand our clients more deeply. I said, "All right, I'll try it out." And so I don't have any clients, but when I got here, I immediately got my CFP and I did take on a couple clients so I could understand the process and understand how things are going. And most of those people were my family members, so I was only abusing them in terms of what I was doing. I told them up front, I said, you know, I have good experts behind me, so don't worry, I'm not actually making any decisions here for you. But as we started developing this values-based approach, I said, okay, I'm going to go out and do some of the first interviews. So the first person I go to is a psychiatrist. You know, and talking to him about his values, and it was quite interesting. It was clearly a cobbler's shoe syndrome. He needed someone to talk to, had not had that opportunity. But you know, it was interesting. He was in incredibly risky investments. You know, private placement type stuff, private equity, and yet his values. You know, several of his values revolved around safety and security, and he had. As a psychiatrist, he had also he did a tour in Iraq and had a fairly traumatic experience. And so here he is. His portfolio is, you know, extremely high beta, and yet his core values are around safety and security. And he was very unhappy with his advisor, but didn't know why. And, you know, as I listened to his stories about, you know, his experiences and how his values, you know, he had some life events that probably had changed his values to some degree, I said, well, you know, you don't have to take that much risk. And it's probably unsettling because there's volatility with that, and it seems to be inconsistent with where your sort of values are today. And the thing about values is values tend to be, when people talk about their values, they tend to be rooted in something either significant in their life that they can tell you that's a story, or they tend to be very lasting. And, you know, risk tolerance questionnaires are great, but you know what? They tend to change a lot. You know, the consumer, the client tends to change their perspective on a lot of that stuff when it actually happens. And instead, when you can really have a conversation with some about their values, you're getting at some root, something that's been around for a long time, and it was a major impression. And doing that, you get a better sense of, okay, well, what's the right place for this client? What's the right planning approaches? What's the right investment strategy? That's going to be a good place for them, despite the volatility of a market.
And is that part of the culture at the firm that your advisors, I mean, are they on board with that? If somebody, when they meet with clients, do they try to actually draw stories out of them so they've got a deeper understanding?
Yeah, I think that, I'll go back to one of the founders. He's, you know, this was the gentleman that was, as I said, he's great at motivating people. He always said, what matters most is that the client understands that you know them and care about them. And I think that's true. You know, from an advisor perspective, look, we have credentialed people all over the place here. One of the things, and yeah, somewhere in your question about how things changed, it was a planning-based firm. One of the first things I did, though, was I immediately hired a gentleman named Jeff Ratner to come in and teach the CFP on site. And, you know, I think at the time when we did it, something like 40% of the company or 50% of the company had their CFP.
What do you mean teach the CFP on site?
So he would come in and teach, you know, people travel around. This is early 2000. You'd travel somewhere and you'd learn, or you'd do it over a two-year period. He did what was called the four-day. He'd come in each section and teach four straight days. We'd do Thursday through Sunday.
And he was teaching certified financial planning. This was working towards getting that designation, or this was just...
That's right.
Okay.
Working towards getting that designation. And one of the things, I had several people who said, oh, I don't like to take tests. I was like, I don't care. Just go to the class. All I care is you have the knowledge. You know. And so, you know, we have tremendous amounts of people here who have expertise and capability. And the world's filled with people that have the right, you know, the right accreditation and education. But at the end of the day, you know, the client wants to know, do you care? And, you know, I think an important way of expressing that is caring to know them and know what makes them tick. And so, yeah, that is something that, you know, as I said, one of our founders really sort of talked about that. And I think, you know, our advisors get that, understand that. It's if you... You know, you can take the approach that you're going to try to talk about sort of all the intricacies of analytics around a specific portfolio. You can do that, but the years of training and learning that have gone into understanding all of that are not going to be, you can't compartmentalize that down into an hour or two conversation for a client where they're going to truly understand it. And so, you want to have them at a place where they can understand enough to collaborate and make sure it's consistent with what they're feeling. At the same time, what you really need to do is build trust. I think you build trust by demonstrating you care.
So let's go back to something you said earlier, because it sounds like this is what really pretty distinctive about the firm. You said that they're not a sales-oriented organization. You saw when you joined over, actually back when you were consulting, I think, with Wealth Enhancement Group, what you saw is that they're an organization that uses education to attract their clientele, to attract customer or clients, rather than going out and just doing the sales routine. First of all, do I have that right? And secondly, if education is what this firm is about, tell me how that was executed.
Yeah, so I'll tell you a story, and then I'll share with you how we do. So this is when I was working with the firm, you know, advising them to, as they were sort of organizing themselves. I was riding down the elevator, and there was a husband and wife riding down the elevator, and they were having a conversation, and you know, most families divide and conquer, right? One member does certain things, the other member or the other partner does other things, and one spouse looks over and the other spouse and says, you know, that's the first time I've understood our financial situation. And it was clear that, you know, who was doing, you know, who was running the finances, sort of partly involved, and that was telling to me. I mean, that was a message that you wanted to hear, because they were talking to, the firm was talking then about, you know, helping to educate their clients and understand what they're doing, and that was sort of, you know, it's anecdotal, right? But it was proof, as I was getting to know this firm, that just to hear that comment. So the firm is very active in both publishing and presenting information. And we do it through a variety of mediums. We'll do it through, you know, most firms do newsletters and we'll do things like that. But we do client-specific webinars by which we'll take a topic and we'll just dissect it. We do a weekly radio show. It's broadcast throughout our network of offices and places we're in. And that show will take a topic and explore it. It's not what I'd call exciting radio. It's not like Kramer, you know. Kramer is an entertainer, right? And a good one, right? And knowledgeable too. I mean, I wouldn't want to suggest anything to the contrary. But it's a lot of entertainment. Our show is a little boring. I mean, it's going to take a topic and explore it, and it's going to explore it in a way that is down to earth. But it's going to make people feel like, oh, you know what? Maybe financial planning's for me. You know, I think most people think financial planning's for, you know, people who have $50 million of assets or whatever, or has been. That's changed over the last 10 or 15 years in the industry. But when I first got here, that was very much some of the view. And the reality is, no, actually, financial planning is really for everybody. And in fact, in some ways, if you have less assets, the level of precision becomes more intense. Planning becomes even that much more important. And so,
well, are these broadcasts then going to clients and would-be clients, or are they for advisors?
So we will broadcast actually on live radio, but then we also deliver that same type of, you know, we'll deliver a variety of mediums directly to existing clients as well.
Okay, so the radio programming you do, you're buying time on a radio station and like a half hour, hour slot, and you guys broadcast.
Hour-long show, doing it for 17 or 18 years now.
How many different radio stations right now?
You know, I think we're on 10. I don't know the exact number, but I think it's 10.
Everywhere you have an office.
Yeah, and so we have, and to give you a sense, I mean, I have a, you know, the marketing group represents about 10% of our employees. So, because we're very active, I mean, in terms of pushing out content.
So you're doing webinars, you're doing radio programs. I think there was another marketing function.
We publish.
You publish. What kind of publishing?
So we've done a couple books along the way, and then we do a tremendous amount of articles along the way as well. Some's internet based. Some's, you know, we'll just do white papers, different types of things like that, presentation materials.
And then, the website also says events.
We do a lot of events as well.
And the events are of what nature?
You know, typically our events are going to be, it's a subject, which, you know, you'll see, in this industry, you'll see a lot of people where they'll have the, you know, mutual fund company or whatever might come in and they present for it. We don't do that. We use our experts and, you know, we create the content and we do the presentation because people are hiring us. They're not hiring, you know, XYZ mutual fund company. And so, you know, our topics are specific to areas of expertise that we have. It's a way for us to showcase our experts. It's also a way to, you know, develop that, you know, develop the client to understand, you know, enough that, you know, this is an area where I should be thinking about this. I should be working on this type of stuff. Tax tends to be, you know, we do a lot of tax, activity. We do tax prep for clients. Tax is a big area.
So let me ask you about...
Not just because of the recent changes, it just always is.
Oh, yeah.
The recent changes are certainly caused a lot of questions as well and concern, but nonetheless, tax is always a big deal.
Yeah, I've seen some demonstrations of tax efficiency to where if you, basically you project out and the impact on the portfolio is quite tremendous. So
we do obviously tax planning around investment approach, tax planning around, we're going to work with clients on what are the benefits that they have at their firm and or benefits that they may be empowered to drive at their firm. Tax in terms of estate planning. It's really, all over the place. And when you think about it, I'm a University of Chicago guy, so the efficient markets runs deep in my in my background. And so when you think of alpha, you can create alpha and the risk is low and the return is clear. And so we can create a lot of value for our clients through just smart tax planning.
Now, the firm does have an investment philosophy, of course, and it's based on four principles. What are those principles?
Yeah, so we talk about effective diversification and, what is effective? I think you maybe asked a question specifically about diversification. I think that the biggest, so much of diversification over the years has been, sort of bastardized, what I call style box management. And, I think that, that's just sort of descriptions of the securities, but they don't really tell you anything about what's the underlying risk. And ultimately that underlying risk, how does it behave under stress? We gentleman I brought in, CIO is a Chicago guy as well. Really, fundamentally we look at and say, where is the risk ultimately coming from? Is it interest rate risk? Is it company risk? Is it inflation risk? Or is it manager skill risk? Because that's the root. Obviously, the most obvious example, right, is are you in high yield and the market, right? Obviously, as markets deteriorate, there's correlations start approaching, one. And so, we want to make sure that as we diversify, do you pay for, and again, a little bit of a University of Chicago mentality, right, is that, not a huge believer that there's a lot of places for alpha to be created from the manager side, but more importantly, we say, we'll pay up for diversification. We're willing to pay for diversification in what we might consider real diversification. I think that the important part is what we call effective diversification. Not just do you own a lot of stocks or do you own a lot of different mutual funds, but, really, what do those look like? What do they look like in times of stress? The other part, essentially, we look at ongoing management. So I don't believe the market's predictive, random walk down Wall Street, right? I don't believe that yesterday is predictive of tomorrow, particularly. But we do believe that there is some predictability over 3 to 5 years, and really on a relative value basis.
Over how many years?
We think in the 3 to 5 year range, you can get a sense of sort of where different parts of the markets are going to play out.
Okay.
If you think about relative value, what might that look like? Third, we think cost efficiency matters. We go back to 2008. I remember reading the headline in Investment News. The headline said, when are advisors going to lower their fees? I don't remember anything saying when are asset managers going to lower their fees. this is more around financial advisors. Or when are custodians going to lower their fees? And so, we really look at it from the perspective of saying, our job ultimately is to make sure that we can drive as much efficiency as possible through our scale and size on behalf of the client, whether that's negotiating with custodians or how we structure portfolios, and how we can find savings within that. And, And we believe strongly in cost efficiency. That's not to say our proposition ultimately to the client, you know, we're not a vanguard proposition. That's not what we're trying to say. But we're also saying that, look, if we can get the type of risk exposure we're looking for and we can do it in a less expensive way without losing value, we're going to do that. Or if we can use our leverage and get better pricing out of the custodian than what you might get somewhere else, we're going to do that actively within it. And then the fourth, which we talked about already, is tax efficiency. We clearly believe that managing through, essentially, tax efficiency has the ability to increase returns. And why would you not do that? So that's really the place to go, is just make sure diversification's there. Make sure we're looking at it at overall allocation on a longer view. We don't make a promise that we are going to, we can't promise that we're going to miss, we're going to be able to opt out on market timing, but near term. But we do believe that we can create return over time, cost efficiency and tax efficiency. All of that lined up with the right type of, one of the key things we always look to is, we don't want our clients to be speculators. We want to make sure that their portfolio is matched up with the return levels that they need and the risk matches their needs, not a situation where we're putting them in a portfolio that they can't stomach and they don't need.
Now, let me ask you about the business owner's consulting practice, just one component of it. You've got, there's four different stages to this: startup survival, which is pretty obvious, growth and expansion, that's obvious enough, maturity, obvious enough. But let me ask you about transfer of management control. Are you talking in terms of bringing professional management, which seems like it would come before maturity rather than after? Are you talking about selling the company to another, basically just selling the company off, or is it either one?
Primarily, from the management perspective, we don't get deep into the management side in terms of, as they're thinking about building their management team. I mean, we can advise, but we're certainly not in a recruiting and or structuring position. Related to, transfer management, oftentimes it's a matter of sort of what's the optimal way. What are your goals? And from a financial perspective, what's the optimal way to do this? Tax treatment being the biggest, but there are other ways too, right? It's how might they structure the proceeds? How might they, what might be their role on ongoing after on an individual basis for them? How might they take the stream? How might they do planning in terms of gifting to family members? It's really around what do I want, right? And this is part of the, you get back a little bit to the values. People say they want to sell their business, but they may not want to quit working. That's not uncommon. So how can they structure that appropriately, and then how do they work through just reducing the tax implication of the transaction itself?
So let's talk about private client services. It says on the website for, and I'm quoting, exceptional private wealth management needs. What's an example or two of something exceptional in the private wealth management, that need of for a client? What would be exceptional?
Sorry. I think not business sale transaction would be an example. We have a client. Probably it's so obscure, I'm going to leave the. They have a collection of antiques. It's a very specific place. It's something that you would never. They have obscure antiques, and it's worth $3 million. Helping them figure out how to liquidate that is an unusual, I'd call an exceptional and unusual situation. Significant part of their, turns out to be a relatively significant part of their net worth. And at the same time, it's unique, but it actually has real value. You would never guess in a million years. Hunting. If I said it, the person, the ultimate client would know, but essentially it's a hunting, hunting sort of accessory, and they have a great number of them, it's quite valuable. And they're, one of the things we're helping them with is sort of, okay, well, how do you actually liquidate that relatively thinly traded market.
You know, one of the really interesting things about the firm, maybe it's not that interesting, it seems on the surface to be interesting, is that you guys are backed by Lightyear Capital, which is identified as a private equity firm that specializes in financial services investing. Can you give me an explanation of that relationship? And was Lightyear involved from the start? Were they the seed capital for the firm?
So actually, no, so when I came into the firm, it was two gentlemen locally who bought the firm, and one was the investment component of a local bank, and it wasn't a strategic relationship at all. It was purely an investment, and the other was the partner's fund of a local sub-debt firm. And so with that infusion of capital, actually the firm went to a place where it had outside shareholders, which in the financial services industry is a little, it's a little different, but I think is incredibly beneficial because when you have outside capital, you're really forced to mature your business in a way that creates sustainability. And, I think it's great. I think it's good for everybody, right? Because shareholders, equity holders they're the last ones to get paid. Essentially any type of capitalization of a firm. And so they care about the lasting nature of a firm. And I know, in the public space, people care about quarterly earnings and all that kind of stuff. But true equity, thinks long-term about the business and thinks about, how can I make something sustainable? Because if you're the last one to get paid, you want to make sure that the firm's in a good place. And so having outside ownership was a great benefit and really was a big part of my willingness to come into the firm because it really forces you to act and behave like a company. As you sort of said earlier, you're a CEO, you're like a real CEO as opposed to, having clients. And that's right. I mean, I did okay with my family and advising them, but that's not what my natural skill is. My skill is more around motivating people and aligning them and helping them, find their passion and pursue it. And so that, we had outside ownership. Those two partners were with the firm until 2007, and at which point Norwest Equity Partners, which is a private equity firm, essentially took their place. Before that, we had seven shareholders who had ownership in the firm, or seven employee owners of the firm. After that transaction, I'm actually a fan of private equity. I know a lot of people have a lot of different opinions about private equity, but I did an interview the other day. Norwest Equity Partners came in at that point and took out the other two, and along with that, we had seven more employees join as owners of the firm, so we went to 14 owners as employees, and Norwest Equity Partners. They were with us from 2007 to 2015, at which point Lightyear Capital came in. And at that time, I had a few people who were older and were heading towards retirement, so it created a liquidity window for them. And at the same time, it created an opportunity for more employees to come in as shareholders. And today, I think we have 52 or 53 employees of ownership in the firm, along with Lightyear Capital. So we've had it's all a matter of how do you finance your business. I like private equity. We're certainly not large enough to be a publicly traded company, nor do I have any, I don't have any ego to go ring the bell anytime soon. We have capital that's, Lightyear Capital's been in the financial services industry for a long time. It's headed by a gentleman, our founder was a gentleman named Don, is a gentleman named Don Marin. He really built Payne Weber. Have a 5-minute conversation with him and learn more about the industry than I can probably spending an hour with somebody else. Along with a gentleman named Mark Vassallo and Stuart Gross and Dan Freeman, all are on my board. And, they've been around the financial services industry for a long time. They worked in it years ago, and they've been in it for a long time. And so you look and say, okay, I've got a smart board with vested interest about caring for the well-being of this company. It's a good partnership. And not all private equity is created the same, but if you pick the right partners,
sure. So the firm is obviously in growth mode. And you've alluded to this already, but where is the majority of the growth coming from? Is it acquisition of offices? Is it organic? If it's a combination of the two, can you give me a ratio or percentage?
The firm, I can give you, some ballpark numbers. So the firm, when we transacted with Lightyear, you know, essentially it was the middle of 2015, was about $4.5 billion. We ended last year roughly at $8.5 billion in assets. Of that, you know, roughly, I'll do the math real quick, but roughly, you know, a little under $2 billion was from acquisitions, and then about $1 billion of that's from organic growth, roughly a little bit more, and then market growth on top of it. And our portfolios tend to, you know, mimic more of like a 60-40 portfolio as opposed to pure equity.
So some of the recent acquisitions you guys made were CLA Financial Advisors, Sound Financial Solutions, HHG and Company, really, you know, fairly small firms in terms of their AUM. What was the attraction to those particular firms or those targets? Was it the market, or I'm sure it was a combination because you have multiple firms within a market, but what comes first? Do you look at a market and say, this is a market that is suitable for us, or it's a high wealth market, and then secondarily, then you identify the firm that you want to perhaps get married to? And if what's the criteria for turning that you know, firm into a bride?
The first thing we look for essentially is alignment with what we do as a firm. So you can't buy a firm and then change them. So we look for firms that have a commitment to financial planning and have capabilities to deliver on it. We look for characteristics around, you know, how do they think about investment management? You know, if they're market timers, you know, we're going to have a big philosophical difference, and it's not, you know, those are a little bit like church and state type conversations. You know, so we look for, you know, we're looking for fit. That doesn't mean that we're looking for clones. No. We want to make sure. I mean, that's you know, you're not going to find it, first of all, and I mean, have opinions, thoughtful ideas. But we look for some core things that say, you know, we're not going to have sort of the church and state arguments with that. And that's so many times when you see sort of factions go bad, it's essentially philosophically people are in different stages. There's no alignment. So we work on that and then find that. And so that's foremost what we're trying to find. From a geographic perspective, you know, we are not why we want to build a national brand. I'm a brand guy. I believe that there's space for a significant brand in the financial planning area. You don't really see one on a national level today, or I don't think it's really dominant anyway. So I think there's a big, wide open space for that. You know, to be established. That said, we're not looking to, you know, we believe that you need to have heft in a marketplace. So, you know, Chicago is an example. Yeah, we bought a small firm, but, you know, they've grown fourfold. And you know, their gross assets this year will be nearly, you know, we've helped them through a number of programs we've done. We've helped them with inflows. Their inflows this year will be nearly the same amount as they were in size when they met us 4 years ago. They'll bring in about $200 million, maybe a little more than $200 million in gross flows this year. You know, that's what we're looking to do. We'll do another, you know, we probably will do another tactical acquisition there for geographic reasons at the right time in Chicago. It's a big market. We want to make sure we have enough talent on board, and then we'll continue to develop people as well. But, you know, Chicago needs to, I mean, we're roughly, you know, $4.5 billion in assets in Minneapolis. I mean, Chicago should be at least that big for us. So we believe there should be heft in a marketplace, more so than, you know, you could be $20 billion and you could have, you know, $400 or $500 million in a bunch of different markets. That's not our view. Our view is that we have a very thoughtful organization in terms of how we develop client leads, nurture into clients. We can go into a marketplace and we can build it out and develop it, of which it might be initially done with an acquisition. It might be a tactical add-on here and there just to get the geography covered the right way, but then it's organic growth and development of people. And so right now we're focused in on essentially, you know, three new markets, and we're always focused in on our kind of upper Midwest area, but Chicago, clearly Houston, essentially the tri-state area of New Jersey, New York, and Connecticut.
Okay, so more acquisitions to come. Where do you want to take the firm from here? So if you're to take the futuristic glance 5 or 10 years down the road, what do you expect Wealth Enhancement Group to look like at that time?
Yeah, so I think if you go back, RAs, you know, RAs have been around for a while. Initially, RAs were people who spun out of, there were a lot of people spun out of full firms and a little bit more on the asset management side. But an industry that's very fractured, right, or very, a lot of small players. And I think even today, I mean, there isn't that, they're mostly small, including, you know, ourselves, where we might be. I definitely think there's a push for consolidation, though. I think scale has started to matter. I think if you go back 20 years ago, 30 years ago, scale didn't really matter in the RA space. I think that's changed. And I think there's two primary catalysts for it that are driving it. One is just the regulatory environment in general. And I'm not just talking about FINRA and SEC, but just, you know, just employment regulations. Just the complexity of running a business has changed. And so I think that with that, you know, scale starts to matter. The other part is technology. Technology has changed in a way essentially now that, you know, if you're a multi-billion-dollar firm, you can take advantage of technology in a way that firms, smaller firms, cannot. And, you know, why does that matter? Well, to kind of go back to sort of my conversation earlier about thinking about, you know, clients and you know, when I was a peer, how do you think about what's the value of a client? And if you can provide a better service such that the client values you more than your competitive alternatives, then you win. And it doesn't work exactly that way, but over time and through the numbers, you know, through the at bats and things like that, you'll win. And so similar with sort of efficiency and scale. If you can deliver more value to the client, or you can deliver to the client the value they want and do it more efficiently than somebody else, then the value of that client to the firm is more valuable, and ultimately that firm will win. So as you look at scale today in this industry, it's starting to matter. And it's technology, as I said, it's technology and compliance. There's also, I think, development of people, whereas the industry really didn't have development of people before. You know, you have to be able to develop people, and if you're going to, you know, deliver a consistent value proposition, and you need to do that regardless of whether you're marketing driven or not.
Interesting. So, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
You know, with scale, you got to be able to handle a client and make promises to them that others can deliver on, and will deliver on. Because when you fail to deliver a promise, you know, you lose the client.
So. In 5 years, what's your AUM going to be? Or in 10 years, what's your estimate as to what your AUM will be?
Yeah, I think, so as I think about it, I look at it and say in 10 years, we want to be, you know, 30 billion plus and one of a handful of players. I think what you see this happening, essentially you see this consolidation occurring in the industry at the smaller level. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of acquisitions going on in that sub-billion-dollar mark area, and part of it's just valuations is part of what's driving that. You see a few billion-dollar-plus transactions. There's not a lot of those. There's a handful out there. But I think what you're going to see is you're going to see what I sort of describe it as you're going to see 15 to 25 firms emerge in that 10 to $20 billion space, and I think you'll see that over the next. Yeah, and these are my time periods. It could be faster, it could be slower, but I think you'll start to see that over the next 3 to 5 years. You can already see that happening today. And then I think 3 to 5 years from now, I think you'll get a different type of consolidation. I think that there will be different financial markets that are available to firms, and I think what you'll start to see, you haven't seen a lot of this yet, but you'll start to see these large firms consolidate. And out of that, you're going to have 5 to 10 firms. And, you know, my objective is to be one of those 5 to 10 firms. And I think the number, you know, 10 years out, I think that number is $30 to $50 billion in terms of assets that start to become significant and higher. And, you know, what are the sort of examples that, well, you look at the broker-dealer space. You know, years ago, there's tons of broker-dealers. Now it's dominated by 10. You get to the 10th, frankly, you get to the 10th largest broker-dealer, you're actually relatively small. So the accounting, you know, sort of other services industries, right, the accounting industry. And, you know, a lot of people say, oh, it's not consolidating that fast. Well, no, it never happens, really. It's not like lightning. But before you know it, suddenly the big 8 become the big 4.